We'd like to get started. We'd like to welcome you out to the RAC meeting this evening for the Southern Region. We'd like to recognize two of our board members that we have. We have Steve Dalton and Donnie Hunter. We also have a new board member that will be starting shortly that's on our RAC, Wade Heaton. Congratulations. Good man for the job. The right man for the job. Very good. We're proud. Let's see. We need to introduce the RAC members. Let's start down on my far left with Riley.
Riley Roberts, representing Sportsman.
Brian Johnson, representing the non-consumptives from Enoch.
Braden Richmond, Sportsman in Beaver.
Rusty Aiken from Cedar at large.
Tammy Pearson, elected official.
Wade Heaton from Alton at large.
Kevin Vennell, Southern Region Supervisor for the Division of Wildlife.
David Black from St. George, represent at large and outgoing chairman.
Nick Jorgensen out of St. George, representing non-consumptive.
Sean Kelly out of Fillmore, representing the Fillmore Service.
Gene Boardman Hinckley, representing at large.
And Sean Stewart, is this on? Looks like it. Sean Stewart, representing the BLM. I'm from Escalante.
Okay, thank you. Our first action item tonight is to accept the agenda and the minutes. I'd entertain a motion for that.
I'll make a motion to accept as is.
Okay. We have a motion from Braden to accept the minutes and the agenda. We have a second from actually from Rusty. So we have that. All those in favor? Thank you. Okay. So the next item will be a Wildlife Board update. We had a pretty big meeting, pretty big agenda last time. Let me find my notes here. I'll just go over some of the highlights. The one of them was on the primitive weapons rule. We had a motion that passed here at our RAC to approve as presented, but to require muzzleloaders to be a sidelock. And that did not make it through the board, but they did recommend to include shotguns. And so it went as presented with the inclusion. Yeah. It went through the board as presented, except to add shotguns. The next one was we had a motion on the Pine Valley deer permits to remain the same and not be increased. The board had a motion to add 300 tags, which passed. And so they explained to us that if we followed the deer management plan, that they could actually add as many as 1,200 tags on that unit, and they went to 300. We had a motion to decrease the number of buck tags on the beaver unit by 500 instead of 300, and they decided to go to stay with the 300 tag decrease as proposed. We had a motion on the bighorn sheep to, and I'm not sure if I can explain this correct, but we had a motion not to to lose those two rifle tags and that it stay the same, but they increased some archery tags, is that right?
Keep any weapon tags the same and add the archery tags.
And that's what went through the board as well. So that passed there. Braden made a motion that we put on an action log to consider the deadline for the applications and trying to move that back to give us an opportunity to see what the tag numbers were. And that actually was talked about and considered. They didn't make it an action log item, but they made it an assignment. And so that's going to be readdressed and reported on in a future date. The other motion that we had also from Braden was on the beaver unit with the antlerless elk. And he wanted to take that new hunt that was a unit-wide hunt and make that just for the northern portion of that unit, and that passed 4-2, so that went through. And I think that's kind of the highlights of the main ones. Is there anything else, Kevin, you think of?
On the beaver elk recommendation, Teresa, do you remember? Did they pass the August?
Yes.
The early hunt as well, so that was part of that.
Yeah, starting August 1 to August 11.
Yeah.
And they went with that early hunt, so. Okay. So with that, I'll turn some time over to Kevin for a regional update.
Okay, thank you, Dave. This won't be news to everybody, but draw results are out, and I think everybody's gotten their email and knows what they drew, or what they didn't draw, as the case may be. I learned some interesting things that I just thought were interesting in our leadership team meeting in relation to the draw that I thought I'd pass on. We go to extreme lengths in Utah when somebody's credit card gets rejected. And we had 7,000 credit cards of those that drew get denied, which is down from what it has been in the past. That's a lower number. It's been closer to 10,000. And so we will try 5 times to get that payment to go through. And then we will send an email, and then we will make a phone call before it moves on. That's going above and beyond. Now compare that to Arizona, where they send an email out the night before they hit credit cards telling people that it's coming, and if your card gets rejected once, you're done, and they move on to the next person. So I think there's probably a happy medium between those two, because I think we go maybe a little farther than my personal opinion than we should, but I thought that was interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Talk to the mic, please. Did they share with you the expense of that? Do you have any idea what the cost to do that is?
I don't think it's all. I think it's pretty automated, but I don't know for sure.
Interesting to know the cost.
Yeah, that would be a question if Lindy Varney's ever down here that she could answer for you. Let me just run through and give you a quick update from our aquatic section. Given kind of where we're at this year, we're going to schedule another ice fishing tournament on the 4th of July at Fish Lake, another perch tournament, so if we could have everybody get ready for that. As you might imagine, our stocking at a lot of the reservoirs has been delayed because we can't get there, but the fishermen can't get there either, so it's probably nobody is even noticing it, but there's a lot of things that have been set back. With the aquatics program, this is the time of year they're doing all their surveys and gill netting, and there's just a lot of lakes that they can't get to yet. So,
can I give you a little update?
Yeah, go ahead, Tammy.
A little local. People are super happy with the bass in the Minersville Reservoir. I'm hearing a lot of that.
Yeah, Minersville, when they did net Minersville, and it came out looking really good. I think I reported that at our last rack.
But we've been seeing a lot of pictures, too. So
good.
Big, nice big fish.
You know, Minersville is one of those lakes that's very productive and can grow big fish. From our wildlife section, probably the biggest news is we're interviewing to replace the Panguitch biologist. We have some really good candidates, and we'll be holding those interviews on Thursday. Habitat section, the WRI funding list should be out by the end of the month, and that'll get them rolling. I talked last time about our new officers. We've got new officers in Millard, Kane, and Beaver counties. They will hit their districts in July, which will leave still two open districts in Garfield and Wayne counties in the state. So, and we will be filling those as quickly as we can. From our outreach section, Free Fishing Day this year is June 8th, and so if there's, you know, that's a day to promote people to get out and experience fishing. We will be having events at Little Reservoir, Bristlecone Pond, and Bryan Head, so that's a great place to send people.
Just those two, especially as two locations. So Bristlecone is at Bryan Head.
Bristlecone is at Bryan Head. Okay, so we will have, okay, Little Res up here on the Beaver and Bristlecone at Bryan Head. Thank you for the clarification. And then there are lots of dedicated hunter projects available right now. I won't document all of them, but there's plenty, and we're getting a lot of demand now that people know that they've drawn dedicated hunter, and Phil's crew is all over that, so and ready for people to come and do their hours. Are there any questions?
Question.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
We used to do an event at Grandpa's Pond down by Hurricane on the Free Fishing Day, and I think that went away with what was his name?
With Grandpa?
Yeah, Lynn Chamberlain, when he was doing that. I was just curious. We used to go and donate some time and money and stuff. Is that ever going to come back? Or
talk about that?
Okay.
And I don't remember there was a reason why we changed there, and I don't remember what they are at this point, Dave. It's been 3 or 4 years since we've done it there. Any other questions from members of the RAC before we move on with our meeting?
Okay, thank you, Kevin. We're on agenda item number 5, which is the wild turkey transplant plant list, and Dax will be presenting for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the RAC. My name is Dax Mangus. I'm the Upland Game Program Coordinator for Division Wildlife. And tonight we'll be presenting our turkey transplant sites. This is a 5-year list. In this presentation, I just want to talk a little bit about the status of our wild turkey populations in Utah. Some of the tools we use for managing turkeys in this transplant list and the ability to trap and move birds is one of those tools we use quite a bit, an important one for us. I'd like to kind of give an overview of what we've done with trapping and transplanting over the last few years. And also, this recommendation tonight represents a transition from a written list of approved release sites to a map-based resource. So we actually, you know, have shapes, polygons drawn on a map to be a little more specific with where we're looking to actually move and release birds. And then we can go through those the proposed release sites. In Utah right now, our current estimate between 25 and 35,000 wild turkeys. Just a side note, wild turkeys are really an incredible conservation success story in the nation. You know, there was a time when the estimated wild turkey population in the entire U.S. was between 25 and 35,000 turkeys, and today it's between 6 and 7 million. So it's a great success. Some of the goals from our management plan for how we're going to manage wild turkeys is that we're going to maintain and improve wild turkey populations to the habitat or social carrying capacities. I guess you could say wild turkey restoration efforts have been so successful that there's maybe in a few areas where we've been too successful, and those are some of the areas where we have conflicts and where this transplant list comes in as handy as a tool. One of our other goals in our management plan is to minimize human-turkey conflicts, to improve hunting opportunities for wild turkeys, to increase public appreciation of wild turkeys, and enhance interagency cooperation in turkey management. The tools for managing turkeys, you know, at the Division of Wildlife Resources, when we can, you know, hunting is our preferred tool. It's a great way to help manage the resource and provide opportunity at the same time. Our spring hunt is really more of a recreational opportunity where we're targeting just bearded birds in the spring, so primarily toms. They don't contribute as much when it comes to reproduction and population growth. So the spring hunt is more of a recreational opportunity. Our fall hunts are a lot more geared towards population management. Your harvest mortality having a fall hunt is much more likely to be additive, so killing additional birds and reducing the population. That's because in the fall hunts we allow folks to kill to harvest any turkey, not just a bearded bird. And on the fall hunts, they're pretty specific boundaries. They're targeted to specific areas where we have conflicts, often private lands or areas just immediately adjacent to private lands where we have conflicts. We have longer seasons and more weapon flexibility on these fall hunts as well. There are some areas in the state where hunting isn't a good fit. In those areas, you know, we do trap and transplant. Hunting is really effective and it's our preferred tool when it works well, but you know, if it's in town or on a golf course, there's places where there's safety considerations or legal considerations and hunting isn't a good fit. And so in those places, we do this the trap and transplant. And when we do our trapping, we really have enough of these areas that's where we do trap and transplant. We're not up on your favorite canyon on public land where people like to hunt turkeys trapping birds. We're trapping birds in areas where there's conflicts, so primarily on private lands or in agricultural areas, those type of spots. And then these birds that we trap, you know, it helps us alleviate conflicts and then also helps us to bolster existing wild turkey populations and in some areas establish new wild turkey populations. This is one of our box traps. This is probably our most common method that we use for trapping turkeys. Winter is usually the best time because they respond best. They're most interested in the bait in the winter. Basically, it's wire panels wired together with essentially a one-way door. And the turkeys go through that one-way door to get in there and eat some corn, and then they can't get back out. Our technicians check these traps regularly when we have them set, you know, multiple times per day. And when there's birds in there, they go in with basically a small shepherd's hook, a pole with a little hook on the end, and they'll grab those birds around the leg and pull them out and throw them in a box, and we'll take them and release them in one of our approved release sites. Over the last decade in Utah, we've trapped and transplanted almost 10,000 turkeys. You can see there's definitely some peaks and valleys, a little bit of noise in this graph, but that's over the last 10 years how many birds we've trapped and moved each year. So last year was about 1,400 birds that were trapped and moved within the state. Our transplant sites, this is something that the Division of Wildlife is directed to do in state code, to identify these sites and take them through the public process and get feedback. And so we're doing that. These sites are developed with input from our regional staff. Our regional biologists look at these areas and make sure that they're places with good turkey habitat, got feed, they've got water, they've got roosting habitat, they have the things that wild turkeys need. We also are sensitive to looking for areas where potential for continued conflict or with turkeys is minimal. So we don't want to take conflict from one area and create a conflict somewhere else. Again, this year we're proposing to transition from a written list of drainages and sites to a map-based resource. You know, I work in the northeastern region, and in that region we have a Willow Creek drainage that's almost 50 miles long and in some places 20, 30 miles wide. So to put Willow Creek as a drainage where we might release turkeys is not very specific. So transitioning to this map-based resource where we identify these release sites, I think it shows more accountability on the division's end and is a little bit more transparent about the areas that we're actually specifically looking at moving birds to. So this new list, if approved, would be valid for 5 years, so from June of 2019 through June of 2024. And with that, I've got some maps of the sites, and if we need to, we can zoom in, and we've got regional staff here if you want to talk about specific areas. On this map, the kind of that yellow color is the goldenrod color is currently occupied turkey habitat. The blue color would be release sites where there are already wild turkeys, so it would be an augmentation. We'd be putting new birds in an area that already have turkeys. And that bright pink color, fuchsia, I never thought I'd say fuchsia in a public meeting, but I've done it twice now. So that fuchsia color would be... What color is that? Pink? We'll just say pink. So... It is wrong here. So that pink color would be, those would be new sites, new areas where we'd be putting turkeys.
So Dax, I know this isn't protocol, but your face is fuchsia at the moment.
You got me there, I think. So there's northern region. The majority of the birds trapped and transplanted in the state come from northern and central regions. Those two regions, I think a lot of it has to do with kind of the suburban oak brush interface across the east bench of the Wasatch Range, where you've got really great turkey habitat right up against really nice homes with really nice landscaping. And that's where a lot of these birds come from. Also Cache Valley, a lot of birds come from Cache Valley and Cache and Box Elder counties. So here's the central region map. These maps show more than just those targeted regions, but and like I said, if your southern region, here's your region here. And if we need to zoom in or talk specifics, we've got regional staff here that can answer questions and talk specifics here. So southeastern and northeastern. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the RAC?
Yeah, I've got a question. Talk to me on the first page under population status. You talk about habitat or social carrying capacity. Tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah, so carrying capacity is kind of the definition of how many animals you can have sustainably. And there's the habitat carrying capacity, which would be biologically how many animals can we hold on the landscape in a sustainable fashion. They're healthy, the habitat's healthy, and they're able to, you know, sustain themselves. A social carrying capacity takes social factors into consideration. If we're talking about the Bountiful Golf Course and the greenskeeper up there is really unhappy about having to clean turkey droppings up off the putting greens, you know, then we've exceeded our social carrying capacity in that area. So that's what that's referring to is, you know, a lot of these conflicts are not necessarily, the turkeys are not necessarily overpopulated from a biological standpoint, but there's the social tolerance for the birds has been exceeded.
Thank you.
Okay. Braden?
Yeah, I'm just curious. On the transplant sites, how far will turkeys move from the transplant site? So a couple racks ago, we talked about sheep. The sheep really will stay where you put them. What do turkeys do?
So, you know, we have some evidence. We've tracked that a little bit. We've been putting bands, metal bands, on the toms that we move. And we've got band returns. Some of them are really close to release sites. Some of them have traveled, you know, 15, 20 miles up or down a river corridor. So some of the birds will move a long ways. One of the things we're looking at right now, and we just are starting a new study, we'll be putting GPS transmitters on turkeys next year. We actually have a couple turkey populations in the state, one by Escalante and then also up in the Mendon area, where we have GPS transmitters or VHF transmitters on turkeys. And those are birds that were not trapped and moved, but native birds that were just trapped and affixed with the transmitter. And then this winter, we're going to be putting transmitters on birds that we trap and move to get a better idea. Like I said, we have some information about how far they'll move, but we're hoping to get more understanding there. And one of the reasons we want to know is we want to know, you know, is this effective? Are the birds surviving? How many of them are surviving? How far are they moving? You know, with proximity to private lands or other areas with conflict, are we causing problems if we move birds within a certain vicinity of other similar situations to the places we took them out of? So we have some information, but we still have some questions that we want to answer with that regard, too.
Okay. Wade?
Dax, it looks like over the last 4 or 5 winters, the numbers of birds that we've trapped and transplanted has just fluctuated wildly. What's the biggest reason for that?
Well, some of it's weather conditions. When we have a more severe winter, you're much more likely to have birds concentrated into these types of areas, and they're more responsive to bait. In a mild winter, not so much. There's other variables too, though. In some of these areas, some of those areas in the northern region specifically, they'll have a really good year for trapping and trap a lot of birds, and they'll actually put a little dent in the population. But turkeys, have a lot of babies. You know, they'll clutch. They can have a dozen babies, and you know, a population can really bounce back quickly. So I think some of it is they're actually putting a dent in through the trapping and the fall hunting. We've been more aggressive with fall hunting as well in these areas. You know, the division would actually like to see those trapping numbers decrease, because that would represent success for us. We'd have fewer conflicts, fewer of these situations. We'd like to trap and move fewer birds and manage the populations more so through hunting. But so I think winter severity and then trapping success drives those peaks and valleys a little bit.
Okay, Riley?
Thanks, Dax. This is really good. This is going to be kind of probably the weirdest question from the rack. Part of the plan is to increase public appreciation for the turkeys. How do you get somebody to like a turkey more?
So, you know, turkeys.
Is there a specific plan in place to? I mean, obviously, this has got to be something social that we're talking about, maybe in some of the more urban areas. But is there something specific that you've got in place to help people appreciate turkeys more than they currently do? I mean, I know everybody loves them in November. But.
So I think the division's made a lot of efforts to reach out specifically to hunters with regard to turkeys. And, you know, we have clinics in all the regions, and the clinics are really popular, well-attended. There's some pretty neat resources on the division website for folks that are interested in hunting turkeys. We have, in the spring, we have two seasons. We've got kind of that earlier season that is a limited entry season, and then we've got that basically May season that's over-the-counter, unlimited permits. So I think the division, we've made a lot of efforts to promote turkeys to folks that are interested in hunting turkeys. And there's probably, you know, I don't know of a lot of specific efforts we've made to help people appreciate turkeys, rather other than maybe trapping them and moving them out of people's neighborhoods. There's probably room for more work to be done with that regard.
Coming from the world's worst turkey hunter, it's this guy right here, literally like 11 tags. I've never killed a bird. I think I'm not using the... That's why I'm the non-consumptive and I'm the Autobahn guy.
Thank you for all your contributions to the...
That being said, I think you should use the color fuchsia in your ads. I think it'll help.
Gene? Do you have any population objective or objectives for turkeys?
We do not.
Okay, and what about turkey predator interplay? Is there any time when you try to reduce predators for the benefit of turkeys?
Yeah, so, you know, most upland game species, very productive, relatively short lifespan. You know, turkeys fall in that group. We don't currently take any predator control measures specific to turkeys.
Okay. Wade.
Sorry, Dax. I know we're not talking about permit numbers tonight, but just to give us an idea, statewide, between the three seasons, what have permit numbers done in the last 5 years?
Man, Wade, I don't know. I'd have to look it up. I don't even dare guess.
All right. That's all right.
We can put that a little bit in perspective. Over the last 5 years, I would guess they probably haven't fluctuated a lot. But if you look at the last 20 years, we've gone from a very limited hunting opportunity to over-the-counter permits. And so if you look at it over just a little bit longer time horizon, the growth in opportunities to hunt turkeys is huge.
And we are moving towards offering more and more fall permits that are specific to these areas where we have conflict. And I know especially in the central region and northern region, they have plans and desires to get very aggressive and issue a lot of permits to try to target birds in those problem conflict areas.
Okay. Any other questions from the rack? Okay. I didn't summarize the RAC procedures, but if you're here tonight to make a comment, please make sure you fill out a comment card. There's comment cards in the back. And you'll be given an opportunity to make that comment here in just a minute. But right now, if there's any specific questions that the public might have, you can come to the microphone and ask those questions. Use the mic on your left. Okay. Do you have a question?
I'm just wondering what the process is to request a trap area for turkeys. I help manage a nature park at the confluence of the Virgin River, Laverkan Creek, and Ash Creek. And I think, to use your term, we've reached the social carrying capacity of turkeys in this area. And so we field a number of complaints from the public in that area, and I'm just curious, if it's not already on your trap list, what's the process to get it on the trap list?
Teresa, do you want to cover that?
My name's Cameron Rogman, Washington County.
And I think the best way is just to call our office in Cedar City. That's our head office. And you can get in touch with me. I'm the wildlife program manager, and we have biologists and landowner specialists. So this time of year, it's a little hard to trap them because there's so many other food sources. But especially once the snow starts to fly, that's a really good time for us to start. And we have been trying to target some of those Tocqueville birds over the last couple of years. But, you know, and then you can always let hunters on there during the hunting season to help disperse them a little bit. But just call our office and you know, on the off chance that they disperse and didn't come back, but just give us a heads up and have some good communication with us. We're happy to help you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Cody and Jason, would you guys raise your hands? If you don't know, these two are the two that cover that area. Would you guys make sure you visit with him tonight? I mean, since you're all here, let's just make the connection now.
I know we also received an email this week from somebody I believe is in Tocqueville, and Teresa jumped right on that and responded back to them, and they were concerned over that very thing. And so I think they're more than willing to work with you and see if we can come up with a solution. So, okay, any other questions from the public? All right, comment cards for this section.
We only have one, and they didn't want to comment, but SFW supports.
Okay, SFW supports the recommendations as presented. Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Comments from the RAC?
I make a motion we pass as presented.
Okay. Do we have a second? We have a second from Tammy. Any discussion?
That didn't happen.
All those in favor?
Unanimous.
Unanimous. Okay. Our next item number 6, will be the collection, importation, and possession rule amendments.
Good evening. My name is Drew Dittmer. I'm a native aquatic species program coordinator, bit of a mouthful, from the Salt Lake office. I mostly focus on reptiles and amphibians or herpetology and coordinate that statewide. I'm relatively new. I've only been in the Salt Lake office since October. And since that time, this is largely what I've been focused on, I'm tasked with working on, is the update and revision of our rules regarding the collection, importation, and possession of reptiles and amphibians. And I've worked closely on updating this regulation with the Attorney General's office and a user group of reptile and amphibian enthusiasts. So I think a good place to start is who are the user group members of these reptile and amphibian enthusiasts. They come from a variety of backgrounds. There's researchers, public land managers, high school teachers, parents, amateur naturalists and citizen scientists, hobbyists, university professors, What all of these individuals have in common is that a strong portion of their identity is tied to an activity known as herping. So herping is like birding in that you go out on the landscape and you look for reptiles and amphibians and you record those species and where you're seeing them and when you're seeing them. However, unlike birding, there's another part of this activity called herpetoculture. And so not everybody who engages in herping also engages in herpetoculture, but many do. So herpetoculture is, in addition to going on a landscape and just looking for these organisms, you might often capture them and bring them home to continue those observations in captivity in your home. So the user group formed because currently they're required to obtain a certificate of registration, or a COR, to collect, possess, import, or breed any species that's categorized as controlled, or they must obtain a variance, that's an exception from our wildlife board for species that are categorized as prohibited. The user group felt, and we agree, that these regulations are complicated and overly restrictive, and they interfere with the general public's ability to engage with this group of wildlife species. Additionally, the user group pointed out that we have a long list of prohibited species, but it will never include everything. There's thousands of reptile species across the planet. We can't possibly maintain a list of all of those species and accurately put them into prohibited categories, so it'll always be incomplete. And we work together to come up with more of a categorical way to put species into the prohibited category. So the recommendations moving forward have several benefits to the Division of Wildlife Resources. At the top of this list is a new constituency group. So herpers, people who engage in herping, reptile and amphibian enthusiasts. This is a group of individuals who in their free time go out on the landscape and look for these animals, which we are charged with the management and conservation of. So we're developing a relationship with this group via this rule change. And they will be piping information into us that can help us better make these management decisions. So the constituency group, we work together to develop harvest reporting and bag limits in a citizen science element. And this will come on the heels of a permit and an education course instead of a COR. So we're going to move to a permit that they'll purchase online after they successfully pass an education course. We're going to get simpler regulations out of this interaction. So we're moving from a roughly 31-page rule to a roughly 17-page rule on the heels of this revision. And we're also going to allow for the sale of captive-born native reptiles and amphibians. And so working with the user group really allowed us to define when an animal is wild and is not wild. And so an animal born in captivity then is no longer wild. It's nothing that's taken from the wild population. So we worked with the user group to really develop that language. COR certificates of registration are still going to be required. We're not doing away with those. So native venomous species for personal use will still require a certificate of registration that will be reviewed at the Salt Lake office. It'll come across my desk, and we'll develop criteria for people who can apply for and achieve that. And we're going to have a two-year review for that process. And so we'll be back here in about 2 years kind of updating the numbers and how many people are actually engaging in that process. Commercial businesses, so if you are breeding and selling reptiles for profit, a significant portion of your income is coming from this process, you will need a commercial COR. Some scientific collecting and educational use categories will also still need a COR. Non-native venomous species will require a variance. So if it's an exotic, venomous, dangerous snake to the state of Utah, that's going to require a variance from the Wildlife Board. And we just want to emphasize there's no permit that's going to be required to capture, photograph, and release reptiles and amphibians. So if you're out on the landscape, you're out for a hike with your son or daughter, or you're by yourself, you catch a lizard, you want to take a picture of it and let it go, it's absolutely allowed. You don't need a permit to do that. This table is just a quick breakdown of how we stack up against other states regarding these regulations. So there's two broad categories, I think, to consider here. So there's the commercial category. We still currently do not allow commercial harvest, and we're not going to allow it with this revision to the rule. A number of other states align with this with us on this. Nevada, Arizona, and Colorado all do not allow commercial collecting. It's allowed to some varying degree in New Mexico, Wyoming, and Idaho. I'm aware of, I think in Idaho, they're going to work on phasing this out. That's my communication with them. They just have a few commercial collectors, and so in the future, they'll probably join the prohibited category as well. Then there's personal collection, so capturing things as a herper on the landscape and bringing them home to enjoy and study in your own home. Utah's still going to be on the conservative limit or the conservative end of the spectrum in regards to regulations of that activity. So We're going to allow personal collection. We're going to require permits for it. We're not going to require seasons yet, but we have the ability to establish seasons based on some harvest reporting structure that I'll get into later in this presentation. We will have limits, and we'll have, a reporting structure. And we stack up on, like I said, the conservative end of that spectrum. So just to break down some of these proposed changes in a bit more detail, the permits and the education course. So the education course is going to be the first barrier to entry to buy your permit. Education course is going to be a PowerPoint presentation that you'll click through and have a short exam at the end, and it's going to cover basic biology of reptiles and amphibians. It's going to focus on reptile amphibian diversity in Utah. It's roughly 15 amphibian species, roughly 61 reptile species. It's going to cover safety. We have rattlesnakes and one venomous lizard in the state, so we're going to cover safety in some depth. Threats from non-native species is a really important area to cover. We have a lot of non-native invasive species issues regarding reptiles and amphibians in the state of Utah. And so people who take this in education course will then be more informed regarding invasive species issues, and particularly the issue of not releasing reptiles and amphibians into the wild that have been in captivity. And we're also going to emphasize that even if they're native, releasing reptiles and amphibians from captivity back into the wild is problematic. They can develop diseases in captivity that then can spread through our wild populations, and it's a hard problem to battle. We'll briefly cover habitat conservation and regulations, but then after they pass the course, the permit can be purchased online. So recommended changes, we're going to move to bag limits for all of our native reptile and amphibian species. We'll have three categories for bag limits. These categories are borrowed from existing regulatory structure in other parts of our Division of Wildlife Rule. And the bag limits, in order of most conservative to most liberal, are limited, standard, and expanded. So we're going to put 14 species of reptiles in the limited category, and that'll be a 2-year bag limit and 4 in total possession. And we worked together with the user group on developing these bag limits. So species that are particularly highly valued are going to go into this conservative bag limit category so that, one, we do get the data reported about who and when and where they're harvesting these animals, but we're also on the conservative end so that we're not expressly allowing a high level of harvest, so that if we do feel that that harvest is excessive, we can move them into a prohibited category. The standard categories for reptile and amphibian species that are not quite as popular for people to capture and bring home, but some people still do, so we still wanted that reporting for individuals who are interested in those species. So that'll be 3 per year and 9 total possession limit. It'll be 10 species of amphibians and 25 species of reptiles in that category. The expanded category is pretty hefty, so there's 25 yearly, 50 in total possession. We're only putting 4 species of lizards in this category. There's several species of snakes that people keep in captivity that really only reliably eat lizards for their food, and so this gives people the option to harvest the food for their pet snake. And the species of lizards that are in this category are really, really common in Utah. Like, if you've seen a lizard in Utah, it's probably one of these 4 species. The harvest reporting is probably the biggest boon that we're going to get with this regulatory change. And as far as I know, we're going to be the only state that is moving this direction for harvest reporting for reptiles and amphibians. So it's going to be an online reporting structure, and people, when they harvest their reptile or amphibian, they're going to be required to report the species, the number they captured, the locality that they captured that species. They're going to be required to report that within 72 hours of the take. So this is going to develop really important data for us about the when, where, of this activity and the timing of the activity of these reptiles and amphibians. This is a data sparse environment for us when we're making decisions about reptile and amphibian conservation on the landscape. And so these people who are out here engaging this activity on their free time are going to be really helping us understand that where these species are on their own time. So this is incredibly valuable for us. Locality information is absolutely essential when you're making decisions about reptiles and amphibians. And so we're going to update this information in a guidebook that's going to be published every 3 years. And so we'll use this information every 3 years to decide if we need to move species back into a prohibited category for over-harvest reasons. Maybe we can liberalize things or move or prohibit certain areas from harvest or take. There's also going to be a category of non-controlled species. So species in this category can be collected in any number but may not be released back into the wild. No permits required for this. So bullfrogs, most aquatic turtles, snapping turtles, red-eared sliders, these are all not native to Utah, and they're problematic. So people can harvest them in any number. We strongly encourage those people to kill them upon harvest, and please definitely do not re-release them. Oh, what did I do? Sorry about that. Finally, we'll have a category of prohibited species. There's still going to be several species that will be prohibited for possession, importation, and some other categories. Non-native venomous reptiles, as I said earlier, are going to require a COR that's approved by us at the Salt Lake office before they can be possessed, and a two-year review is going to occur for this process. We do want to emphasize that even if somebody wants to try to apply for a permit to get a venomous snake, they're still going to have to be compliant with their local laws at the county and city level. Just because we give a CR that does not trump any local laws that prohibit that activity. Crocodiles, alligators, caimans, if it looks like an alligator or a crocodile, that's prohibited. Prohibited amphibians are those amphibians that are native to the state that we have conservation concerns for, so relic leopard frog, Arizona toad, Columbia spotted frog, boreal toad, these are all prohibited from capture and possession. And two native reptiles, Gila monster and Mojave desert tortoise, these either have threatened and endangered species issues or we have current conservation agreements for these species, so they'll be prohibited. And any species with a conservation concern can be listed as prohibited or prohibited by area closure at any time. We can move things into this category on a need basis. Propagation. So again, local, municipal, and county ordinances apply if people want to breed their pet snakes. So if they go out and they harvest their legal bag limit of snake species X, and some most cases this is going to be king snakes that are popular for this activity. They can breed those and they can sell the offspring. As long as the sale of the offspring doesn't exceed the cost of basic husbandry of your animals in captivity, that sale is allowed with your basic permit. If you're moving into a very profit-based model, then that's going to trigger the need for you to have a commercial COR. We developed a packet of this regulatory change, which included a briefing paper and a letter introducing this regulatory change, a list of all of the species and the bag limit categories that they would fall into, and we sent it to the Utah Department of Health and the Utah Department of Agriculture. They had no concerns, and they supported the rule as written, and the Department of Health expressly liked the educational component that we're including with this regulatory change. So just to summarize, we're moving to a permit process instead of individual COR applications for the collection of wild reptiles and amphibians. There's going to be a required online education course that'll be the barrier to entry to apply for your to purchase your permit. We're going to establish bag and possession limits for reptiles and amphibians, native reptiles and amphibians. We've established a mandatory reporting structure for reptile and amphibian harvest or take, which will be online, and it'll be really data valuable for us in the native species unit, native species section, for making decisions about management and conservation of these species. We're going to allow the sale of offspring of wild-caught reptiles and amphibians. You cannot sell a snake. You cannot go out and catch a snake and sell it. But if you breed that snake in your home, the offspring are allowed for sale. Non-native venomous reptiles are prohibited, variant required, and native venomous snakes will still require a certificate of registration. So just to end up, I just wanted to thank everybody. Again, I'm a relatively new employee in the Salt Lake office. I had a lot of help from my supervisors in the aquatic section while working on this rule. Worked very closely with the user group. Two members of the user group are here tonight. They showed up for many meetings that were 6 to 9 at night to help work through this process and come to an agreement about this rule, which is really helpful. People in the licensing division have been really involved. All this online reporting and the online permit structure, working really closely with the licensing division. The law enforcement division, especially Jay Shirley and Rick Olson, were really involved in this process. Really want to thank them. And, just in general, thank you for your time tonight and entertaining this rule.
Thank you. Do I have questions from the rack?
Yeah, I got one.
Gene. And then we'll go with Nick.
Probably most of the horned toads and lizards are taken from the wild by seven-year-old kids whose families have no idea that there's any regulation at all on them. What do you do with them when they're located, and is there any punishment for them? Or
I don't foresee there being any punishment for youth trying to, you know, engage with nature, but it's up to us now that we're all informed here at the RAC that this is a new rule. We're responsible for informing children that we have regulations on the harvest and take of wildlife at all levels. The UDOT Division of Wildlife Resources is responsible for all wildlife species, so it's just up to us to help encourage people to buy that permit and do the reporting so that we really get that information. And we want to encourage children to get out there and do this activity. That's why the permit's only $10. So, and the course will be very approachable for young children for online.
Nick? I want to see how these regs apply to an instance I had a few years ago, rattlesnake in the backyard, grandkids down. What should I have done?
We'd have to defer to LE. You have property protection allowances, so if there's a dangerous snake on your property, I believe you have the ability to kill it. You don't need to buy a permit for that. Again, I would love it if you would buy the permit and report it online about the data, because it's important information for us to know. So I'm, you know, you do what you got to do in your backyard, though.
Okay, thank you,
Sean.
Yeah, I just curious. I wasn't aware. Do we have large viable populations of non-native turtles?
Yes.
Where are those?
Point to water.
St. George.
Any water.
Yeah. I mean, I was just down in Washington County this weekend. It was not a problem to find red-eared sliders in any of the waterways there.
Most of the warmer areas within the state?
They can even subsist in some surprisingly cold water.
Just interesting.
Anybody this way? Questions? Brian's dying to say something. Dig deep.
Did you say herping? If you want this to be popular, you just have to offer a bonus point and then make it hard to draw, and everyone will want to do this. Maybe a mentor program.
We have volunteers who sign up to help UDWR employees do surveys and work for snake surveys and other species, and then they can get all the dedicated hunter program. So we have people in the user group that are involved in the dedicated hunter program to earn points.
Is there a way to offer this? From what it sounds like, and this is a serious question, it sounds like the reporting is more valuable than the money. We don't care about the $10 that we're getting. We care more about the reporting. So is there a way to offer this free for kids under 12 so they can report the lizard they caught? I mean, that helps the education part of it. And as a dad, I don't want to pay $10 so my kids can catch a lizard. But I'm just throwing that out there as something to maybe discuss or not discuss. I'm fine with it either way. But, I mean, under 12, if you just advertise it as reporting, I think that it would help get the word out.
We're in early stages. We don't have a fee structure that conveniently fits this model. So that's why we're having the $10 fee. And as the reporting comes in and as people buy into this process, we may enter something where we have non-resident applications, non-resident fee structure for this. People travel with their kids to come to other states in the Southwest and go herping. So right now, I would argue to like maintain it as is, just so we get that first few years of information, and then we can move to and again, you know, the user group themselves, they wanted a buy-in structure. They wanted to pay into it. And if we can get to a spot where people buy a license for this, then it becomes DJ eligible money for management of this, which is great. But we're in early stages. We're just sizing this up right now.
One thought I had is it seems like this would be a good program to maybe take into the schools to let the kids know that it's there and maybe get them excited about it.
Sure.
As well. Anybody else? Riley?
A comment and a question. One, I actually learned a lot in this that I had no idea, so thank you. Very well done, Drew. And looking down through, the first things that were coming into my mind was, is there a concern? Obviously, you've already talked about the turtles. The first thing that came into my mind was the mussels at Lake Powell. And pythons in Florida and some of these other non-native species, do we have a concern for some of these things coming in? And I mean, is there... Are we at that point yet with anything? I mean, obviously, if we've got a lot of turtles down in a lot of the waterways, that's something. I mean, are sure. we going to have to? I mean, can you educate me a little bit more on some of that, please?
Sure. So Florida is going to be a famous example, but we're not Florida. We're not bordering on the tropics. So a lot of the things that are there, don't worry about those particularly getting established here. Bullfrogs are extremely abundant in Utah and not native. They're extremely problematic. They are a reservoir host for amphibian diseases. So the amphibian diseases that are causing declines in boreal toads, Columbia spotted frogs, that disease persists in bullfrogs because it doesn't kill bullfrogs, but it lives in them. So it maintains it on the landscape. So there's many levels to these problems. Turtles can also harbor diseases on the landscape. They can carry rhinovirus, which is a disease we haven't recorded yet in Utah. It would be very worrying for some of our amphibian species. These things are really abundant on the landscape, and we are worried about it. Like I said, I've only been here for about 6 months, so I'm just trying to get momentum to figure out what to tackle first. As far as like imported species in the pet trade that could get established, just because of our climate and elevation, we're kind of limited on what can get established. So a lot of it's going to be things that alarm me are things that are native to the same latitude but in the eastern U.S. So all of these turtle species, other side of the Continental Divide, they're native. My home state of Missouri, those are all native turtles that are common. I'm not surprised they're here, but yeah, it's an issue, and we're not full of ideas on how to address it yet, but we're getting there.
Thank you. Anybody else? Tammy.
Since how you're the expert, I'm going to ask you this. Where the heck do these toads show up in water places that have never had water in it before? So like our West Desert stuff, you know, I mean, there's never been water, and now we have toads croaking out there.
Yeah, you're probably seeing, my guess, based on what you're describing, is you're seeing spadefoot toads, super, super common in desert areas, but almost never surface active. They can live beneath the soil for years in some cases. They're triggered to come up by rain, and they'll find the first available source of water and start calling and start breeding. They're really common in arid areas all across the West, but they're probably one of our most common frogs that most people don't see very often.
They're ugly little critters. Literally ugly little critters. One other question. So I'm a desert rat, not into herping. Well, I shouldn't say that because we do love the horny toads and that kind of stuff. So I am kind of
a
herper, or whatever you want to call it.
Like a larper.
Okay, sounds creepy. There's another critter that comes up in the floods in the some of our flood controls above Minersville. That's a little shrimp critter looking thing, and they said it's some sort of a prehistoric.
Yeah, it's a tadpole shrimp. It's one of the scientific categories for it is a triops. It's a really ancient invertebrate, can live in dry soil for ages.
I don't think we'll be quite in that. Maybe just this year.
Well,
make sure
you get your okay. Anybody else? Do you have any questions from the audience? Please come state your name at the mic.
I'm C.J. Rowley. Growing up in St. George, I was just curious if there is any way I can report if I've found certain things. I've been interested in herpetology for 30 years, so...
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I'd encourage you to use is iNaturalist. So the Herps of Utah is a section on the iNaturalist webpage that I monitor, and we will be increasing our monitoring of that and importing that data for just people who go out and make casual observations. So absolutely use that. I'm monitoring it every week. by the permit when it comes available to report that data. If it's a species of particular high value, I'll give you my contact information at the end of this, and you can report it directly to me. If you're in Washington County, there's another guy there that is also interested in knowing that stuff.
Okay, and then once, if this goes through, once they get the permit, is that for a certain amount of years, or is it a lifetime permit?
You'll have to renew it annually. So, and it'll be, if you do take something home, your renewal will be contingent on you actually reporting accurately and timely your what you took.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, good. Any other questions? Okay, comment cards.
Two, SFW doesn't want to comment, but they support it.
Okay, SFW supports the plan as presented.
And then Brian Hamilton.
Brian Hamilton.
Hi, my name is Brian Hamilton. I live out in Snake Valley, so I'm actually on the Nevada side, but it's pretty much Utah. I just finished my PhD at BYU on rattlesnake biology, and I was part of the user group that worked to develop these new regulations. And I'm in the presentation, too. My kids are a few places. I just say our group, we really deeply care about reptiles and amphibians the same way hunters care about the opportunity to harvest big bucks. For example, Beaver Canyon is the type locality for the Utah Mountain King Snake, which is the snake on my hat. And until then, it's been difficult to do research and to enjoy the reptiles and amphibians in Utah. So we really work towards simplification to make this easier and accessible to all people. That was part of our goal with that. We thought the education component was a great opportunity to educate folks and teach people about reptiles and amphibians. So, for example, what do you do when there's a rattlesnake in your yard? It's a common thing in Utah. And it's a place where we could engage people and get the safety information out there. I do research on rattlesnakes. I've been working on rattlesnakes in the West Desert for 20 years. And one thing I just found this year, I caught a female that I caught in 2003, and we put little chips in them. And she was a five-year-old snake then, so they can live at least 20 years. And I only know it's at least 20 years because I've been working with them for 20 years. So there's a lot we still have to learn, and this would make research in Utah a lot easier to conduct. The data collection and harvest reporting with, I think this is like cutting edge. No other state does anything like this. And part of the issues we had before is we didn't know where these snakes that were less common, where could we find them? Is it only Beaver Canyon? Are they in every canyon in the Wasatch? And this would give the division a lot more information to better manage the resources in the state of Utah. And I feel like that was a really important step. And the harvest regulations, we think they're very conservative, and they're not going to jeopardize the continued persistence of these species in Utah. And that was a deliberate, they're conservatively low. So that shouldn't be a big concern. Utah has a world-class herpin. Folks, you guys may have just heard the word, but believe it or not, people come from all over the country and all over the world to Red Cliffs Desert Preserve to have Cameron take them out for the opportunity to see a Gila monster. It's really a big thing, and this just sort of allows not only people in Utah but across the country and the world to enjoy the incredible reptile and amphibian diversity we have in this state.
Thank you. That's all the comment cards. Do we have comments from the rack? Looks like we're ready to entertain a motion.
I have a comment.
Okay.
I would like to pass the motion as presented.
Do we have a second?
I'll second that if you let me make a comment.
Okay.
Obviously not many of us are familiar with this, and so I really appreciate Drew and getting just members of the public involved in these other user groups. I think that's a theme that has started to happen in the division. And Brian, thank you for all that you guys have done. I think when we get invested, educated members of the public involved in these processes, it really is a benefit to all of us. So thanks to both of you.
Okay, we have a. You have another comment, or you?
Just one.
Okay.
You live in Snake Valley?
Yes. Yeah. Not, I can't make this up. They're lying to us.
I'm okay.
Okay, call for a vote. Okay, we're ready to vote. If you call for a question, theoretically you have to vote on the question. So I think we're ready to vote. So, okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor? Okay, great. Okay, item number 7, other business. Before I turn the time over to Kevin, I just wanted to say thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor to serve, and I've learned a lot, and it's been a very good experience for me. And there's two things that I know for certain, and I know that this is a very effective process. I believe in the RAC process. We have a great wildlife board. We have great RAC members. And I also know for a fact that our wildlife are in very good hands, and we have a lot of good people that are looking after their interests. So thank you.
Thank you, Dave. And any of the other offgoing or RAC members, that today's your last meeting, if you have anything you'd like to say, we'll give you that opportunity in just a minute. Before we get there, we need to nominate and elect a new RAC chair and vice chair, and then I want to talk to you about my ideas on filling seats on the RAC and get a little feedback there, and then we have a little presentation we'd like to give to the RAC members who will be for whom this is their last meeting. So first item of business is, do we have any nominations for the RAC chair? Nick?
Well, this is going to come as a surprise to him, I think, but I'd like to nominate Braden down there.
Okay, we have a nomination for Braden. Braden, is that a nomination you would accept?
Yes.
Boy, there was a lot of confidence in that. So Wade just asked for a refresher of who will be departing the RAC. So Rusty, Mike Worthen, Dave, and Brian, and then Wade. You can't be both on the RAC and the Wildlife Board. So we have five members of our RAC who will be departing. Okay. Tammy, I don't know that we need a second on a nomination, so we have one. Any other nominations for RAC chair?
Tell us who we're missing.
So missing tonight we have Craig Lobb and Verlin King. And then Mike Worthen, but Mike's not going to be on the RAC anymore, so he wouldn't be part of this. I think that's it of our. And Mike has been the vice chair.
There's kind of a part of me that wants to punish Verlin for not being here. I don't think he can not accept the nomination at this point. I'm just saying, I nominate Verlin.
As the vice chair or the chair?
The chair.
Okay. I would like to have a conversation with someone before they take that on, but.
And I'm good with that. I just don't know. I understand that.
Is this Brian being Brian?
It's redacted. Yeah. I'm redacting that. He's not here.
I was going to nominate.
Okay. I don't see any other nominations.
I have a nomination. I'd like to nominate Riley.
Okay. Riley, is that a nomination that you will accept?
I
So Kevin, here would be my concern with that nomination.
And yours or Riley's?
Maybe his too, but this would be my concern with my nomination. And I probably am curious just to hear your input on it. The concern I would have with that is I wanted to be on the rack so I could have a voice, and I feel like as a chair you should have less of a voice. You should conduct the meeting, but you shouldn't offer your opinion as much or ask for things. And that's my hesitancy in that position, because I want to have an opinion.
Okay. Braden, I would say I would disagree with you that you shouldn't have or share your opinion as the chair. You are limited on when you vote, and the only time you would vote is to break a tie. But you're on the rack as a sportsman's rep. You would still be representing sportsmen as the chair,
okay,
and should voice your opinion as the sportsman's representative.
Then I feel more comfortable with that nomination if you're comfortable with that.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any reason a rack chair should feel. Certainly you need to give everybody a voice and allow all of the opinions and comments to be made, but I don't think that limits you should feel limited in offering your own opinion.
Okay.
As the chair.
And that's exactly was my same concern. It was almost like we'd talked about that or something. But for real, there's a lot of weight that is carried by the individuals on this, and I for one take it very seriously, and I love it when it is attended well by our community and by the individuals. That's why I'm grateful for those that came tonight. I was very educated tonight, and that's why I vote the way I vote. And that means a lot to be able to have that voice and that vote.
Okay, so Riley, with that having been said and a new understanding, are you open to the nomination? And no is an okay answer. I don't want someone serving as a chair reluctantly, to be honest with you.
Keep in mind, you are going to end up going to how many board meetings a year? They're going to ask you to go and report. Is that, I mean, that's part, let's maybe talk about the responsibilities for a second.
Yeah, one of the things that you need to be available for and have your employer be willing to allow is attending for every RAC meeting a board meeting that's an all-day affair. So,
I would decline in this moment, especially where there's already a nomination for someone I think who is well represented.
Okay. So it sounds like we have one nomination for the RAC chair. So I think at this point we need to take a vote. All in favor of Braden Richmond as the new Southern Region RAC chair.
Are we voting too?
Yes, you're still on the RAC. So that including the departing members of the RAC, all in favor. Okay, looks like we have a unanimous vote there.
Sorry, Braden.
Okay, so vice chair. So the role of the vice chair is obviously to fill in both at RAC meetings and potentially board meetings if the chair is unavailable. I told you that I was uncomfortable having somebody nominated to be the chair when you bring up Verlin without having an opportunity to talk to him. I don't know what his employment situation and all those things are, but I think vice chair, if you wanted to make that nomination for Verlin and or Riley or others, I think that's appropriate. So.
Would you be okay with that, Riley? Ooh, Craig Law.
Okay, Tammy has nominated Craig Lobb as the vice chair. Do we have any other nominations for Vice Chair? Rusty?
I'd like to nominate Riley.
Okay. Riley? Any rebuttal as for Vice Chair? Okay. Any other nominations for Vice Chair? Okay, let's take a vote. All those who would like to vote for Craig Lobb as the Vice Chair, please raise your hands. Okay, all those who would like to vote for Riley as the Vice Chair, please raise your hands. Okay, so our new RAC chair by a unanimous vote is Braden Richmond, and our vice chair will be Riley Roberts. Thank you for both of you for your willingness to accept those nominations and to serve. So now, for those of you who tonight is your last meeting, Rusty, anything that you would like to share?
8 years, I really appreciate it now. On the RAC. It's been educational. I think we've got a lot accomplished. I think our herds are in better shape than they were 8-10 years ago. So, appreciate it.
Thank you, Rusty. Brian, anything you'd like to add?
Pass the microphone up.
I didn't think you would.
No, I don't. That's not what I do. I first started coming to these RAC meetings back when the dedicated hunter required you to do so. That program literally changed my life and got me into bow hunting, where I became a non-consumptive. And I developed the opinion at that time. Some of you could get that. When you get that, go ahead and laugh. But I developed the opinion that the true test of another man's intelligence is the degree in which he agrees with you. And that's extremely wrong. And I've learned over the last little bit that as long as we get out and enjoy the outdoors, it doesn't really matter how we enjoy the outdoors. So if I could leave anything with you guys, that's kind of my biggest thing. And we learned a couple of things tonight that I had no idea about. So thanks for the opportunity to get to serve, and it's been a pretty good trip. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. And Mike Worthen is not here. Wade, anything that you'd like to add to your comments on your time on the Southern RAC?
I'm not going very far, so you'll still have to hear me for a while. But I just want to echo what Dave brought up. I have a lot of faith and a lot of confidence in this process. I really do. It's not perfect, but the ability that the public has to walk into a meeting and make a presentation that could potentially become a part of the way we do business is remarkable, and I really believe in it. I also believe in the group of people up here and the Wildlife Board we have now. Great guys volunteering there, and ladies. Great people volunteering their time in something they believe in. And I just appreciate people that are willing to volunteer and not just complain, that actually bring in good ideas to the table, solutions, and try to solve a few things. I think that's a great, it really is a great system. And quickly, last, I've really grown to have a lot of respect for the division through this process. I've only been on here for 4 years, but let me say this. The people that work at the division now, we've made some significant strides, in my opinion. They're quality people that really want to do their best. And the principles they make decisions by, I just really appreciate. I respect them, respect their opinions and their values. And they're just great, hardworking people that really do have the wildlife and citizens of Utah at their heart. So I appreciate them. Thanks for all you guys do.
Thank you, Wade.
Okay, one last thing that we'd like to do. Jason, could you and maybe a couple people grab those prints and come and line them up right here in front of the, along this table right here, so that the RAC members can see them?
I've got a daughter and you know, I need
So let me tell you a little bit about these prints, and then, and I don't know what order we're going to go in, but each of you that are leaving the RAC will have an opportunity to select one. These are all prints that were painted by a man named Clark Bronson. He worked for the Division of Wildlife in the 60s and 70s, and we own the rights to all of these prints. He painted them as a division employee, and so which is what gives us the opportunity. They're beautiful prints. If you've been in my office, I have many of these that you see in front of them. There's a collection of I think maybe 60 of them, ranging from lots of non-game species up through kind of the iconic ones that you see in front of you. And so they're beautiful prints. We present these to you as a thank you for lots of hours on the road and time in long meetings and late meetings. And please remind me as we do this in future years to make sure that you all get one as your time with the RAC comes to an end. I think what we want to do... the other thing that you can do, those of you who are departing, go ahead and take your name tag, slide it out of the little thing there, Mr. Chairman. You can take the chairman one too if you'd like. We can replace that. You also obviously get to keep your gavel. I don't know of a better way to do it. And so Dave, as the chair, would you? Is there one of those that you would like to select?
The one on the end.
So the colored elk print, why don't you go put your name tag on that one so the others know it's taken. Yeah, and Tammy's suggesting a group picture, and we can do that at the end. And then, so since there isn't a better way to do it, Brian, pick which one you'd like. Wade's anxious, so go ahead, Wade.
No, Rusty.
Oh, Rusty. Sorry, you're right. And we are missing Mr. Worthen, so I will invite him over to the office to select from what's left. So the members of the audience, you haven't had a chance to see these. If you want to come up and take a look, please do. They're beautiful prints. Dave selected a color print of an elk. Wade selected a black and white print of a moose. Rusty selected a picture of a bear with two cubs and a porcupine. And Brian selected a picture of a Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep. So they're beautiful prints. Why don't you guys go grab your prints and then where do we want to take a picture? You're the picture guy, Phil. Okay.
Can you get the whole group in now? I think you ought to have the whole group.
If you could all go.
Try that. Yeah.
They can stand in front of the picture.
Just right there.
Yeah.
Okay. Go. If anybody wants to come take a look at these pictures, they're beautiful pictures, and then go grab your pictures, please, and bring them up, and let's get a picture. I think we are done. The meeting is, we've done all the business. Do you want to adjourn the meeting, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Pretty neat.
Done.